I'm Jim Copeland. Those of you who are regulars know me. I direct the Center for Legal Policy here at the Manhattan Institute. For the last 20 years, we've been engaging the civil justice system that we believe, continue to believe, has gotten out of control in a number of areas to the detriment of the American economy, the American consumer, and ultimately, in this instance, American health. We have really wanted to focus particularly on this area of medical malpractice and insurance because it's such a key component of the national debate. About 10% of all tort costs go to medical malpractice, and medical malpractice insurance premiums have been rising rapidly, although not consistently, for the last 30 years. So it's a major problem, especially in some states and certain parts of the country. But there has been ongoing dispute between parties for this. We tend to say this is a function of the tort system. The trial lawyers and consumer groups that back them tend to say this is really all a price gouging scam from the insurance industry. Groups such as the Americans for Insurance Reform and its parent group, the Center for Justice and Democracy, continue to put out studies, as does Public Citizen, that make these sorts of assertions. These studies last week were read into the debate, into the record on the Senate floor by the minority leader, Senator Reid. Even though these studies have been discredited, I think, pretty widely, they're entered into the debate. And Senator Ted Kennedy, in discussing why it was a good idea to vote down medical malpractice reform at the federal level, said the problem is not in the courtroom or in the legislative halls, but in the boardroom. So these assertions continue to be made, and we wanted to get a real strong economist who does a lot of work in law and economics and in econometric work to take a look at it. So we're very lucky to have been able to work with Alex Tabarrok, who, along with Amanda Agin, wrote this study. Alex, the primary author of the study, has done some of the leading work in the field of law and economics looking at the tort system. I'm going to give a little plug for his book. We may do an event on his book later in the year, but we wanted to go ahead and get this study out here. But Judge and Jury, which he co-wrote with Eric Helland at Claremont McKenna, who is his co-author on many of his seminal works in this area, looks at various factors in the tort system, everything from how race and poverty affect jury awards to how elections versus selections affect judges' behavior and awards in those areas. He really has gotten a lot of acclaim. He's one of the four or five young scholars that is an expert in this area. He is a professor of economics at George Mason University, where Amanda Agin is as well. He's also the research director for the Independent Institute, and he's published a number of books outside this area. He's got a number of interests overlapping with us, including things such as the Food and Drug Administration, drug approvals, things like that. So I'm going to let Alex come up here now and explain to you his results. I think they're exciting, and I think they're definitive, and I think they're really going to let us know where the facts are. The late, great Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, men are entitled to their own opinions, they're not entitled to their own facts. So we're going to look at these facts. Alex.
Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction, Jim. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. It's well known that since 1999, medical malpractice rates, as indicated by this graph, have increased dramatically by 50% or more in some specialties. And higher health insurance premiums have caused some doctors to retire early, to reduce the types of operations and procedures that they perform, or even to move to another state with a better liability environment. And as a result, tort reform is the top priority of the American Medical Association because, quoting them, escalating jury awards are seriously threatening patient access to care. That's the AMA. Now, the AMA clearly links premiums with higher awards, as do insurance companies, for example. And you know, that makes sense in that awards are what premiums are meant to cover. Other people, however, have pointed to a lot of other things. So other people have said that recent increases in premiums are due to factors like price gouging, for example, or the insurance cycle. So J. Robert Hunter of Americans for Insurance Reform says there's no justification for the sudden spike in rates that American physicians have endured other than lack of competition, okay, and so forth. Treister and Brinkley, in a New York Times article, pointed to the following graph, and I'll focus first on the left-hand side, your left of the screen. They pointed to the following graph, which plots total medical malpractice premiums against total payouts over the past 30 years. Now, the graph seems to show, if you look at the most recent period, it seems to show that the recent spike in premiums is not associated with an increase in awards. Okay. Eyeballing the data, however, is not always the best way to go. Great, thank you. Okay. And some more advanced statistical analysis shows that premiums and payouts are co-integrated. Now, what that means is two things. First, it means that premiums and payouts are very difficult to predict. In particular, that past measures of premiums and payouts don't help you very much to predict future measures. That's one thing the co-integration test shows. I'm going to return to that point in a moment. The second thing which the co-integration model reveals is that although awards are difficult to predict and premiums are difficult to predict, we can be confident in predicting that wherever awards go, premiums will soon follow. Okay. Premiums track awards in the long run. Now, rather than getting into statistical details, I want you to take a look at panel B, the right-hand side of the figure. This is exactly the same data. Okay. All we have done is now simply overlaid the two lines. And I think just simply doing that actually tells the story much better. You can now see much easier that premiums track awards in the long run. Now, when the two depart from one another, there can be a period of catch-up. Okay? Indeed, from panel B, you can actually see that the mystery is not why premiums have shot up in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. The mystery is actually why premiums were below awards in, say, the period from about 1985 to 1995. What's been going on with the recent increase in premiums, as you can see from the graph, is really a catch-up factor. Premiums have been catching up to awards, which had begun to increase dramatically. Now, with this in mind, we can discuss the so-called insurance cycle. The idea that it's not awards which are driving premiums, but something to do with interest rates and investments and stuff to do with the insurance industry. Now, this idea, it's not so much wrong as woefully inadequate and misleading. The reason is this. As I mentioned earlier, awards show no tendency to return to their mean over time. What that means is that information about past awards is not very useful information for predicting future awards. Because of that, the most useful information for predicting future awards is just the most recent awards. What happened 5 years ago tells you nothing. What happened in the past year or two might tell you something. If it's anything is going to tell you something, it's the most recent awards. Now, by definition, however, there aren't very many recent awards. So insurance companies have a tough job. They have to predict future awards based upon just a handful of current awards and what they think is going to happen. So it's not at all surprising that they sometimes get their forecast wrong. They're forecasting based upon a limited set of information. Was the latest billion-dollar case, was it just a fluke? Okay. Or is it a sign of a permanent change? We haven't had many bankbusters recently, perhaps. Does that mean the long night of escalating awards is over? Or is that just a temporary respite? Now, not surprisingly, insurance companies, as I said, sometimes get these forecasts wrong. So, short-term departures of premiums from awards is exactly what we would expect given the volatility of awards. Tort awards and the insurance cycle, therefore, are not competing explanations for premiums. It doesn't make sense to say, oh, no, it's not awards, it's the insurance cycle. No, the insurance cycle is driven by changes in awards. The unpredictability of awards is a driver of the cycle. And so the best means for dampening the insurance cycle is to dampen awards. All right, so most of that I just said. Okay. Turning from the time series, looking at the trend in awards over time and how premiums track awards, let's take a look at awards across the states. Let's see. Okay, so the insurance cycle. Sorry, going to catch up here a little bit. Yes. Okay. All right. This is a graph, a map of medical awards per doctor across the United States. These awards can vary dramatically. They're about six times higher in Pennsylvania, for example, than in Wisconsin. Can it possibly be that doctors in Pennsylvania are six times worse than those in Wisconsin? If you took a doctor from Wisconsin and you moved into Pennsylvania, do you think his insurance rates would stay at the Wisconsin level because he was a Wisconsin doctor? Okay, no. Okay, of course not. Okay. There's much more variability in awards, and I'll come back to this point shortly. There's much more variability in awards than can possibly be explained by variations in the quality of doctors or even in the types of cases which the doctors perform. Now, since awards vary so dramatically across the states, ranging from about a high in Pennsylvania of around $10,000 per doctor, okay, to a low in Wisconsin of around $1,600, since awards vary so dramatically across states, we ought to see that premiums vary across the states as well. And in fact, they do. Okay. Premiums are higher in states with higher awards per doctor. So, we have evidence from the time series that premiums track awards over time. Now we have evidence from the states that premiums are higher in states with higher awards. Okay. We've just eliminated the insurance cycle as an explanation for rising awards, or more accurately, we have put the insurance cycle in its proper context, which is as an effect of awards, rather than as an independent cause of changes in premiums. What about then price gouging? Okay, what about this idea of price gouging? Insurance companies are price gouging their doctors, Robert Hunter. Expensive insurance rates become a matter of life and death when they drive doctors out of business, as is happening in Connecticut. Insurance company greed can be hazardous to our health. It's Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal. Now, the problem with these, there's a lot of problems with these price gouging explanations. One real puzzle is greed new? Okay. Did greed suddenly become so much more pervasive between 1999 and 2005? You know, was it the case that Mother Teresa was running Allstate Insurance, you know, prior to 1999 and was booted out in favor of Attila? Okay, did I miss that news? Right. Was this just the half decade of greed? Okay. Why now? Moreover, this price gouging explanation, okay, seems if somebody's being gouged, you ought to see that somebody else is doing really well. Okay. Well, if this was the case, why then did the St. Paul companies, one of the largest sellers of medical malpractice insurance, why did they leave the industry in 2001 just when gouging, you know, should have been making them extremely happy? Did they have a guilty conscience and just too many profits forced them out of the industry? It seems really unlikely. Putting aside these points, the price gouging hypothesis requires a lack of competition. Okay, if you're going to say people are being gouged, then the only time that's going to be possible in a free marketplace, okay, is if you have a lack of competition. So the price gouging hypothesis predicts that prices ought to be higher in states which have fewer companies or less competition. Well, what do we find? Well, what we look at is we look at the top four firms, the share of the market held by the top four firms, concentration ratio, which is a standard measure of competitiveness. And so a concentration ratio of 60% means that the top four firms hold 60% of the market. Okay. Well, what do we find? If competition is driving up rates, we'd expect to see a positive correlation between premiums and the concentration ratio. In fact, what you see is a negative relationship. So if anything, prices are lower in states which have higher concentration ratios, in which the top four firms have a larger share of the market. Okay? That could be because there's basically no relationship, although it's statistically significant, it's small. It could also be, actually, there's a consistent economic explanation, which is, how do firms get big? Okay. How is it that a firm comes to gain a large share of the market? It's not by raising prices. It's by lowering prices. Okay. So it makes sense that if some of the firms in the industry have a lot of economies of scale, a lot of efficiencies, perhaps they have better management, they're able to drive prices down, they get larger. So in states which have larger concentration ratios, you may in fact see lower prices, which is what we find. Okay. All right. Having shown that awards are the key to premiums, we might want to ask, well, what is driving awards? Okay. And here we basically replicate an analysis found in more detail elsewhere in the literature. In my book, Judge and Jury, American Tort Law on Trial, but as well as in other places. And so I'm going to be fairly brief. Basically, the question we ask is, it's easy to see why teenagers pay higher auto insurance rates. It's because they have more accidents. Okay? Can we explain why awards are higher, so much higher in some states than in others? Can we explain this based upon similar kinds of principles? Is it the case there's more medical malpractice going on in these states? And the answer is it's really hard to find any explanation, any rational explanation like that. Awards are higher in states which have higher income per capita, which makes sense since some of them are compensatory, so there's some rational basis. Okay, but that only explains a minority of the variation. And there are other factors, political factors, things such as whether a state uses partisan elections to select its judges, okay, which also influence how high medical malpractice awards are in those states. So there's a lot of reasons why awards are higher in some states than in others, having to do with legal culture and tort law, and having nothing to do with medical malpractice. Okay. Now, the final point I want to make today, it's new to this paper, and it involves a comparison between the tort system and the medical review board system. Every state has a medical review board that investigates and disciplines physicians who have been alleged to have violated codes of conduct or the law. Okay. Typically, these medical review boards have an investigator, and then they have a panel on which there are some physicians and some lay people. Okay. And I want to compare and contrast briefly the medical review board system with the tort system. There are actually benefits and costs to both systems. Okay. First, in the medical review board system, complaints can be brought by anyone who suspects negligence. Co-workers, employers, patients, even concerned citizens. In fact, in many states, other doctors are required by law to report a physician to the medical review board if they think that the physician is doing something unethical or medically wrong. In the tort system, claims can really only be brought by the injured party or by the family of the injured party. On the other hand, the tort system has an advantage in that it gives damages to victims, so it has a compensatory role. Okay. Also, because the tort system gives damages to victims, the victims have more incentive to sue. So for that reason, you might suspect that the tort system would uncover more problems because the victims have an incentive to bring these problems to light. Running contrary to that, however, is the fact that filing a lawsuit can be expensive and time-consuming. The medical review board system doesn't give damages to victims at all. On the other hand, submitting a complaint is relatively cheap and easy. You can even submit a complaint anonymously. Okay, so it's relatively easy to get a review started. Okay. So you might expect for that reason that more people would use the complaint system. The tort system, how does it discipline physicians? Actually, a lot less than one might imagine. For example, most physicians have medical malpractice insurance. So there's no direct punishment. Awards are usually paid by insurance firms. No direct punishment of physicians. On the other hand, in the medical review board system, it's actually much more of a potential threat to a physician because their license can be suspended, revoked, limited. They can be disciplined by having their practice monitored. Okay. They can be required to go through retraining. They can even be fined. Okay. Another aspect of a benefit of the medical review board system is that you can have a complaint before there's an injury. So if, for example, a patient smells alcohol on the doctor's breath or thinks that the doctor is inebriated, or perhaps a coworker has evidence that the doctor is doing drugs or something of that nature, okay, they can bring a complaint and you can have a disciplinary action before any injury has actually occurred. Okay. On the other hand, in the tort system, it's difficult to sue unless you already have had an injury. Finally, in the tort system, or let's look at the medical review board system, problem with the medical review board system is that decisions are made by physicians. Physicians do dominate these boards. Now, the physicians have the benefit of understanding how medicine actually works, but they have the defect, perhaps they're going to be reluctant to penalize other physicians. In the tort system, you have decisions that are made by lawyers and judges and juries who may not understand very well the practice of medicine, but they're a little bit more independent than the medical review system. Okay. So we have some costs and we have some benefits, and I think actually an important research question is to look further into these and to try and ask whether the medical review board system could substitute for the tort system, or could be used more often, or could be improved and strengthened. Now, one thing we do in this paper, further comparison along these lines, is complaints which result in disciplinary actions are reported. And we have data on those reports. So what we can do, which are called adverse actions, so what we can do is we can compare the number of tort cases per doctor and medical awards per doctor with adverse actions. And the idea is that both of these systems are trying to get at the same thing. They're trying to get at medical malpractice. So we ought to see if they're both working well, we ought to see that these should correlate with one another, because they're both trying to do similar things. And in fact, you might suspect that even if the medical review board system is less likely to discipline, when they do discipline, it's going to be for an important problem precisely for that reason. Okay, so we ought to expect these things to correlate. What do you see? All right, that's what I just said. Well, when you look at these adverse actions and you run them against medical malpractice claims per doctor and things of that nature, what you find is essentially zero correlation, no relationship. So looking, for example, at the top left graph, medical malpractice claims per doctor on the x-axis, adverse actions per doctor on the y-axis. What that shows is you can have some states which have twice or four times the amount of medical malpractice claims per doctor. They don't have more adverse actions per doctor. Okay. So states with a lot of medical malpractice do not have a lot of adverse actions. Same thing in terms of awards. There's actually a little bit of a negative relationship. But basically, states which have very high awards, you do not see the medical review board system saying, ah, yes, you're right. That's why in this state we also have a lot of adverse actions. No correlation between these two systems, even though both systems are trying to identify medical malpractice. Okay. The other two graphs on the right-hand side look at a subset of adverse actions, some of those which are most likely to be related to medical malpractice. Some of the adverse actions, for example, include billing fraud. Okay, so we exclude those and we look at different version of the adverse actions. Again, no relationship, perfectly flat. So one of these systems has got to be wrong. Okay. All right, let me conclude. Rising medical malpractice awards drive insurance premiums higher. Over time, premiums track the growth in awards. Across the states with higher medical malpractice awards have higher medical malpractice premiums. The insurance cycle is not a competing explanation to changes in awards. Awards are a driver of the cycle. Price gouging is not a plausible explanation of the recent increases in premiums. Awards and claims are related to some factors that might rationally be related to medical malpractice, but they're also related to things such as partisan elections for judges that are not at all related to medical malpractice. The tort system and the medical review board system are independent methods of determining malpractice. The two systems, however, are not at all correlated. One of them must be wrong. Improving and extending the medical review board system so that it might serve as an alternative to the tort system, I think, is a good area for future research. Thank you.
My name's Harry Lewis. I'm an attorney here in New York City. I've represented physicians groups in connection with these kinds of issues, although I'm not a medical malpractice insurance defense lawyer. 2 years ago, I actually testified in front of the Connecticut legislature in favor of strengthening the review board in that state, which was woefully underfunded in a Democrat-controlled legislature. And my clients certainly believed, and I don't know if this is true, but it was their belief that there was a correlation between inadequate funding of the medical review board and the desire of trial lawyers who were influential with a faction in the legislature for the review board to be ineffective and underfunded. So I want to suggest that to you as a possible explanation for the lack of correlation. There's actually a motive that bad doctors not be thrown out of the system.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Second, there was a problem with accused physicians, that is, accused before the medical review boards, suing their accusers, which is a huge disincentive. They're using the litigation system, the tort system, to create a huge disincentive for the system, the medical review system, to operate efficiently or effectively. Right. But just wanted to share that information with you today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Those are both very good points. And I agree that I think if the public were more aware of the medical review board system and perhaps could be made to be more confident in that system, if it were not so dominated by physicians, and perhaps some of these problems which you had mentioned were cleared up, if the public were more confident in that system, then I think it could be expanded and could serve as a substitute. But clearly, we have a long way to go on that issue.
Just following up on Harry Lewis's statement about suing the accuser, I had that experience. I had an ethics complaint against a judge that went to a mayoral committee, and these are supposed to be confidential and only report to them, and I was sued by the accused, and it took 9 years of litigation and pro bono intervention on my behalf before the case was thrown out. And if I'd had to pay for it, it would have been ruinous. So that if there is any board system, a prerequisite for it should be immunity from the libel suits by the accused.
It's, right.
How can you ask people to expose themselves to that?
Sure. Yeah, and I think one of the problems with the tort system, which I have not did not deal with today, but which your question raises, is that doctors are so fearful of being sued that a lot of useful information which could improve medical malpractice, which could improve practice, doesn't come out. You know, one of the important ways in which, let me step back, we ought to remember that medical errors are a serious problem. Okay? Absolutely, medical errors are a serious problem. The question is, does the tort system address those errors in a rational and productive manner? Okay? So I don't want anyone to think that I or anybody else involved in medical malpractice reform is trying to brush errors under the table. On the contrary, one of the reasons, one of the problems with the tort system is that errors are pushed under the table, is that you don't see them as much as you should because people are afraid. Okay? If errors could be more easily be brought into the light and systematic changes in medical practice made, I think we would be a lot better off, and the tort system actually impedes that.
My name is Jim Posner. I was interested to come today because I spent a lot of time analyzing data on malpractice in the 70s and 80s when I was active in the insurance business, and there are a lot of interesting themes you're going into, but I'm a little disappointed in some of the following areas. I'd like to see more data and description to illuminate some of the things you're talking about. You tend to put together awards, which are determinations in court, with payouts, which involve settlements. Awards typically don't involve the appeals and the final payouts, and it's a very tough area to look at awards and how they go. A lot of your data, most of your data is statewide, and a lot of the variability and the issues are within states and with and between specialties, so that we hear the stories about obstetricians, you don't hear the stories about pediatricians and psychiatrists, or in the 1970s, the big specialty that was having problems was anesthesia. Well, technology has solved the problems for anesthesia. Technology has created problems for obstetrics. I think there are a number of areas here. I thought your chart between medical review board and tort system needed a lot more fleshing out, such as how many medical review board actions are there across the states? Very few. They're driven by doctors trying to look at the quality of care, not looking at injuries, whereas the tort system is saying, what are the injuries? So I think that there's just, your presentation is interesting, it raises a lot of questions, but it calls for a lot more data, not just correlations, not just statewide averages, but to analyze the concepts before going into the conclusions.
Sure, that's fine. We look at payouts because that includes both awards from trials and settlements. And it's absolutely true that settlements is where most of the action is. But the tip of the iceberg drives the iceberg. It's the awards at trial which drive settlements. people settle cases in the shadow of the law. So these settled cases where both the defense and plaintiff's attorneys understand very well what can happen when the case goes to trial. So we're trying to look as much as possible at the whole iceberg, not just awards. Second kind of point, I agree with you on that a lot of the variation in awards is within states at the county level. And we talk about that in the paper. And some of my other research uses larger data sets where we look within states. And it's definitely true in Pennsylvania, for example. It's Philadelphia where the awards are extremely high. As we point out in the paper, there's been about as many awards, medical malpractice awards, over $1 million in Philadelphia as in California in entire, as in all of California. Okay. So it's definitely true that there are within state factors which vary across the counties, which are also important and taken up more in the paper itself and also in my book, Judge and Jury.
I'm Barry Carroll from U.S. Steel. I wonder if you've looked at the concept of specialized health courts where independent judges who have built a body of knowledge in the area and could weed out junk science from sound science could provide an alternative and get it out of the hands of juries and provide a more objective and consistent
right.
set of verdicts across the right. system in malpractice cases.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we are seeing a trend in law towards more specialized courts generally. Patent court was recently, about a decade ago, created. I think there is a call since medical malpractice, since the medical care involves so much high technology and so many very specialized questions, which it requires a great deal of knowledge to understand and a great deal of knowledge about how medicine operates, cutting edge medicine especially, that I think there is a real call to have judges who specialize in that type of area and who can more consistently create awards. So I think Phil Howard is starting up some trial plans in New York and elsewhere, which would try and use these specialized courts. And I'm looking forward to seeing the results of those experiments.
Hello, I'm Harriet Edelson. I'm an independent writer here in New York. And I covered medical things over a period of 20 years, and my recollection was about these medical review boards. My recollection at some point, maybe you covered this right before I got here, I'm sorry I was late, that doctors would move from state to state, and I don't know if there's a clearinghouse or whether you mentioned a national review board,
right.
but my recollection was that this was one of the major problems that would actually hurt individual people, and I'm sure there's all different sides to this story, but
right.
that is there any type of a clearinghouse and any way of checking, as doctors do have and continue apparently to move from state to state?
Yeah, yeah, indeed there is, and that is where our data comes from. There did used to be a problem, perhaps still is to some extent, but there used to be a problem, exactly as you say, of doctors moving from state to state, which was why the National Practitioners Data Bank was created, and that is the source of our data. And so all hospitals, all review boards, basically any universities, any place which evaluates a physician, they must report these disciplinary actions to the National Practitioners Data Bank. So since 1991, there has been a national data bank, and that's where this information comes. Yeah, doctors as well as dentists and who are also covered in this data bank can no longer move from state to state with as much ease as they could, because this is all nationally reported and required to be reported. Now, there are some problems. It is possible, it's certainly possible for a doctor not to be reported, but if they are reported, it's national, let me put it that way. And whenever a doctor is hired, the hospital queries the National Practitioners Data Bank.
I'm Paul Lindhurst of Lindhurst Consulting. In your data, it seems that more awards per doctor is really the key variable. And I just wonder, is there any idea why? Why are there so many more awards in, say, Philadelphia than in California?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One thing we find, which is important, is surprisingly how judges are selected. Okay, and we find that judges who are selected using partisan elections, so they're not appointed, and they're not even elected, they're elected just like other politicians are, on a partisan ballot, a Democrat or Republican. So in these types of electoral systems, awards are much higher. And one of the reasons for that is, if you think about the typical tort case, not just medical malpractice, but now I'm going to talk more generally about torts. If you think about the typical tort case, the plaintiff usually sues in the state in which he lives. The defendant, however, may be a out-of-state corporation, maybe even an out-of-country corporation. So especially when you have that system, an in-state plaintiff and an out-of-state defendant, an elected judge is going to be biased, has incentive to be biased towards plaintiffs, because plaintiffs are constituents. So higher awards, that's like constituency service. In fact, you can see this more generally. Exporting tort awards, it's very much like exporting taxes. Why is it that Florida has lots of taxes on hotel rooms? Because Floridians don't pay those taxes. Those taxes are paid by non-voters. So politicians like to put taxes on the non-voters. So exporting tort awards is like exporting taxes. So partisan elections, we also find that counties, not in this paper, but in my book, Judge and Jury, counties with a lot of high poverty counties have very high awards, surprisingly so. So there are a lot of political factors, as well as simply legal culture. And exactly why this is difficult to explain. Why does legal culture vary from one place to another? Okay. But it does vary, and it varies dramatically, and much more. The differences in awards are much more than can possibly be explained by any reasonable differences in the quality of physicians.
Natalie Ruoff from the New York County Medical Society. Do you think that the $250,000 cap that we've seen in California, which seems to have lowered the premium so significantly, and which we know the AMA wants, if that ever were to occur, let's say in New York State, that it could change things dramatically?
I think there's little doubt that a cap would change things dramatically. The only possible issue is, what exactly are you going to cap? Are you going to cap total awards? Or are you just going to cap non-economic damages? Are you going to cap economic damages? See, if you simply cap non-economic damages, so-called pain and suffering, then there is a tendency for the economic damages to become inflated. So it's very difficult, to put a lid on these things. So I think a cap in general would work. Okay, over time, you might kind of see it begin to be eroded. So ultimately, I do think that what is needed is, although a cap may be a short-term fix and may be useful, ultimately, I do think that what is needed is a change in attitudes, okay, and a change in how we handle medical error, and perhaps in the type of courts which look at these things. So a cap is a very stopgap measure. It's a very crude way of saying, we got to get these things under control. And although I can understand why people might want a cap, I would hope that they look at some broader issues and look more fundamentally at the system.
Hi, my name is Alex Lubarsky from Health Media. Brilliant presentation, first of all.
Thank you.
Secondly, I wanted to ask, these tort reforms and the differences in insurance and trying to work with that whole system. My question is, why are there so many mistakes in the healthcare system itself when we're dealing with life and death? We don't see that in our computer industry, transportation. We rarely see it in a lot of other industry. Why is it so pervasive in healthcare? And are all these things the result, perhaps, of the system itself that are creating it, and we're just kind of looking to chop at the leaves rather than the root?
Right. Well, you're definitely pushing me beyond my area of expertise. Amanda? why are there so many errors in the medical system? Well, first of all, it's, of course, extremely complex, the medical system. And patients are very heterogeneous. Okay, every single patient is different. I do think that we need to look, as the anesthesiologist did, at not individual physicians. I don't think that's where the problem is. It's not individual physicians who are making errors and we need to somehow punish them more or discipline them more. That's not predominantly the problem. As what the anesthesiologist found, for example, is things like in some anesthesiology machines, you turn the tap to the right to turn it on, and in other machines, you turn the tap to the left to turn it on. Okay? And there was no consistency. So even a doctor who was being perfectly reasonable could easily make a mistake if the machine was one way and he thought it was the other way. So what the anesthesiologist did is they said, look, let's start at the beginning and look more systematically. Where are these errors occurring? Let's not talk about punishing individual physicians. Let's look at a system-wide approach. And they were able to reduce errors in anesthesiology. I'm sure many people here know the data much better than I do, okay, dramatically. And other physicians, other specialties are beginning to do that. Okay? And I think that's the way to go, not so much looking at the tort system as a solution, or even the medical review board system, but looking at more comprehensive. Kaiser has been doing a very good job. Kaiser, see, has control over the entire medical procedure from the initial diagnosis to the ultimate surgery or whatever it happens to be. And so by looking at every one of those steps, how information is transmitted from doctor to doctor, computerizing records, okay, I'm amazed that only in the last year has my physician, you know, printed my prescription, okay? This doesn't take brain surgery, you know, when you have to understand that a doctor's scrawl can be misinterpreted, okay? All right, finally, we're in the 21st century, we're gonna print a prescription, thank goodness. So those are the sorts of things I would look at.
My name is Bob Guthrie, I'm a retired surgeon. Can any useful information be obtained by studying any other national health systems, or are they so different that the information is not useful?
We certainly know that our tort system in the United States is the most expensive in the world, and we do not get fewer errors because of it. There is very little evidence. If you look internationally, for example, just very crudely at accident rates, and you compare that with the cost of the tort system, zero correlation. So you can have a very expensive tort system, does not deter. Okay, there's very little evidence that the tort system does a good job at deterring. Okay? So other countries also have problems with medical errors. That's a worldwide issue. That's certainly not restricted to the United States. But they have much cheaper legal systems, okay? And they're certainly are not worse off for it, and they're probably better off.
My name is Deborah Cascotto. I'm a journalist for WebMD and several other journals. I just wanted to respond to your question as to why the healthcare field is so different. First of all, you have a multitude of different types of patients and education and compliance, patients' compliance with what the surgeon or the doctor is saying. You have geographic areas. I know you said Philadelphia has a high rate of malpractice. Well, I think a trip to the Bronx, I've sat in trials where I've been exposed to jury verdicts. I mean, there's so many more factors that contribute to the complexity of the healthcare system, unlike any other system in the country, possibly even in the world, and that's what we're trying to figure out in terms of how the best way to get control of costs. Also, it's probably the only system in the country where the patient, at least 90% of the time, is not directly responsible for the cost of services rendered. That in itself affects all the other decisions being made about that person or that patient's health care.
All right, I said I'd get you out by 9:30.
Thank you.